Hello, and welcome to It's a Fandom Thing. I'm your host, Erin Marlowe, and each week I'm joined by a panel of guests to discuss all things fandom and pop culture, primarily from a female perspective. You'll find everything from fanfic to cosplay to Schitt's Creek to Supernatural and everything in between. So put on your favorite piece of fandom merch, set aside that fanfic that you're writing about your OTP, and sit back and enjoy this week's episode. Hello, just a quick note here before we begin our interview with Midian. This interview was recorded originally back in March, so it's a pretty old interview. So I did meet up with Midian again. So what you're going to hear here is this first part is just part one with her, and then I will introduce part two when that comes up as well. So thank you so much. I hope you enjoy this interview. Hello, and welcome to this special episode of It's a Fandom Thing. Today, I'm excited to be virtually sitting down with the co-founder of Munster Makeup Effects, Munster Midian Crosby. I have known Midian for a long time, so I'm very excited to have this conversation with her. She's a female practical special effects makeup artist. She's worked on over 30 feature films, some television shows. She's worked on like The Walking Dead, Lovecraft Country, and just numerous films. So I'm just really excited to talk to her about the world of special effects, especially being a female in that world, and then a couple of other fun little things. So Midian, if you want to just introduce yourself, and just if there's anything else about your background you'd like to tell the audience.
Hello, and glad to be here. Thank you, Erin. This is a pleasure, and it's always great to talk about fan things, right? And, you know, get some... shine some light into the world of special effects and movie making.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so. So what was it that made you want to delve into the world of special effects? What was it that attracted you?
Well, I've always been kind of attracted to the dark side of things. And I think a lot of that has to do with a number of different elements that I grew up with. One is that I have a brother that's 19 years older than me, and he would bring me like things like Fangoria magazines and Cinema Fantastique and these different magazines that had a lot of horror and different special effects in it. And he also for a brief time worked at a mask making company. And I just, that was kind of the only experience or that exposure that I had to kind of that world. Growing up in Colorado, I didn't know anybody that worked on any kind of production whatsoever. It was like, you know, this kind of unknown thing. But I think it was as early as like watching Clash of the Titans as a kid and kind of watching some of the things in that, being amazed by it, how they could bring Pegasus to life and these beautiful monsters. It was also the first time, I'd say, with Clash of the Titans, I noticed that there were credits. There were kind of these people that were up there, whether it was a producer or a director. I didn't know what they did, but I was kind of fascinated by it. And then just kind of noticing all these different things, but also getting exposed to a lot of Hindu and Buddhist iconography. We moved to India when I was 4, you know, being exposed to things that look terrifying but are actually protectors, we call Vajrapanis. I actually have a tattoo of Vajrapani, and they look really devilish and scary. You know, you have like the elephant god Ganesh and all these things. Really, I just loved them as a kid because they were good. And so getting exposed to a lot of that. And then, you know, at 6 years old, Michael Jackson's Thriller came out, and huge Michael Jackson fan. Of course, you know, anybody growing up now into special effects, it's going to be, you know, hey, I heard Soft Face Off for the first time or whatever. but, you know, that first uncut, you know, long video of the whole thing, you know, and you get to see Michael Jackson as a werewolf and a zombie, and you still love him. I mean, you did. And that made a big difference in how I saw, you know, creatures and monsters growing up. I was always a fan of Frankenstein's monster and kind of the sympathy you have for these creatures that are misunderstood. And then I got into like the X-Men. And eventually, I about 12, 13 years old, I saw a book, a set of books while I was visiting my brother, and it was Clive Barker's Books of Blood. And they had these really gross covers, and I was just totally fascinated by them. And I'm not sure if I asked to borrow them or if I just borrowed them. But in any case, I did get into Clive Barker through my brother as well. And that kind of opened up this whole new world of horror visuals and the fantastic, as he calls it, which is kind of like, you know, dark imagination. I always, you know, The Dark Crystal was also a huge influence growing up. And, you know, Ghostbusters, gosh, I grew up in the 80s, man, like the best time for practical effects. Like, how can you not grow up in the 80s and not be totally fascinated and in love with practical effects? I mean, I think it's kind of, that was the heyday. That's what we all want to work on, is that kind of stuff. And it's kind of unfortunate that anybody doing it right now, I feel kind of like, you know, I missed out on, you know, that kind of like great 80s stuff. But then anybody coming up now is also going to miss out on a lot of the stuff pre-CGI. And so I know where I'm kind of like skipping ahead a little bit, you know, and just kind of like, but all of this does tie together. It's like what you're influenced by, as well as, you know, what you're seeing and what, at what ages. The moment, I mean, it really did happen like suddenly in several different points. And at 9 years old, I was at a Christmas party my dad had taken me to for his work buddies, and they were partying, and they just put me by the TV. And John Carpenter's The Thing was on. And I am 9 years old, and I'm watching this thing. And the dog scene literally had me completely, totally freaked out. But at that point, it really made me think, like I said, I know this isn't real. It looks so real. How did they do that? Because that was just such a mind-blowing effect. And it was really disturbing, because I love dogs, you know? And yeah. And unfortunately, I've learned some things since then that I don't really want to talk about, but that kind of mar that a little bit, it doesn't change the fact that it's really, really impactful. And so, you know, when people, I don't know, we keep our kids so sheltered, but so much of the stuff I saw that was possibly even quote unquote inappropriate for me really did affect my life and direction of creativity in the future.
Yeah, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing if you hadn't been exposed to that stuff. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And you wouldn't have pursued that. I mean, I watched horror starting at like 5-6 years old is when I first, like, it was like Poltergeist was my babysitter showed it to me. So yeah, I mean, you know, when you do see that when you're younger, I do think there is a part of you that like I have weird fears and strange fears because of watching so much horror. But I also appreciate that I was able to do that, and that like my dad would show me, and my mom never would because she can't stand horror films, but my dad would show me, you know, like Alien and all that stuff. So yeah. Yeah. And it does inspire you and make you wonder, you know, how does someone come up with that stuff? How does that stuff get created? And you already delved into a lot of movies that did inspire you. And I know Clive Barker, I know you've already delved into that a little bit, but I know Clive Barker is a big inspiration for you. I mean, you changed your name, of course. So I don't know if there's anything else you want to talk about with Clive Barker, because I know how much Clive Barker means to you.
Of course, yeah. For especially for listeners that, you know, may not know of any of the Clive Barker mythos, you know, he's the creator of Pinhead and Hellraiser, and the one that really got me was Nightbreed. I read Cabal and went and saw Nightbreed. I was one of three people in the theater. I saw it when I was 14. I think I was 14. It was NC-17. So my parents actually, my mom lied to let me go see that. They were going to see Henry V, and they thought, oh, I'll just, you know, let her go in there. And they really didn't ask for ID back then. And so the guy kind of was like, you raised an eyebrow, but there I was in an NC-17 film as a 15-year-old. And it was amazing. It really blew my mind. I loved the creatures and all this stuff. And in the story, Midian is a place, and it's a place where the monsters live. But just like with Frankenstein and, you know, X-Men and all these other things, the monsters are actually kind of the good guys. And they're persecuted by the humans who misunderstand them and want to destroy them. And so I've always been an oddball. I've always been kind of like the strange one and the outcast, the creative, the sensitive. And so you feel on the outside already. And then there's this like beauty in the darkness of some of these stories that is just so intriguing that it really changed my world. I had a friend that changed her name and I thought, oh my God, that's something you can do. I had a very, very boring name, Jessica, and it did not suit me at all. I didn't like it when I was 2. I was telling people to call me Casper after the friendly ghost. you know, whatever, you know, Jess or Jessie, because just wasn't a Jessica ever. And so at 15, right before I went into high school, I was actually able to legally change it. Went to court, had to have it printed into the paper. You know, my mom was really cool about all that stuff. And, you know, my mom and I used to also listen to or watch USA Up All Night with mostly Gilbert Gottfried.
Yes. I think
was the main one when I was doing it. But there were a few other hosts. Mm-hmm. And so we watched a lot of bad movies, too. And so just entertainment was a huge part of growing up. And then I got HBO in my room with headphones at 12. I stayed up all night long watching all kinds of movies, especially in October. So, yeah. If it was out, yeah. I was influenced by it, I'm sure.
Yeah. And USA Up All Night. Oh my gosh, man. I remember spending hours watching USA Up All Night. And there are certain movies that I remember scenes from, and I could not know that, and I could never remember the names of them because they were just these really awful, horrible movies, but they were so entertaining. And I wish I could remember the female host. There was one female host that would be on with him and I can't remember her name, but
yeah,
it was great. Well, who do you look up to in the business as far as other special effects artists?
So here's the thing. It's like, I would say, you know, when years ago, and when you're kind of like starting out and there's this, you know, kind of hero worship that we all get with the people that we hear about the most. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say, you know, Greg Nicotero was always like the number one, and I got to work with on the same film and kind of in Pittsburgh, kind of crossed paths with him several times. And we worked on some of the same movies, but in different kind of areas. And I always really was impressed by how he worked with his team. You know, I kind of wish I had looked into more just everyone in special effects and kind of started reaching out to more people when I graduated college, which we can talk about in a minute. Like, there's different ways to get into this business. I'm not sure if I did the right one, but who knows? There's right ones for different people. Mm-hmm. And it's so complex. We could probably talk at 2 hours just on different ways to learn and get into this industry, because that's a whole ball game. I wish there had been kind of like more people around me when I was growing up that did this, that I could kind of understand more about the industry before I got into it. Because after I got into it, it was really more about just getting good and doing better. And a lot of that was on my own. But there are so many really great artists. And the people that I admire the most now are the ones that I've worked with. You know, the people I can see what they do and what they overcome and the skills that they have. I've done some work for Robert Kurtzman over the last couple of years. And he, you know, it's like we talk about Greg Nicotero. He's the K of the K&B. And then, you know, you got Howard Berger and then you have Robert Kurtzman. He was the K, and he kind of split off where the other two kind of stayed in L.A. Kurtzman kind of stayed or went back to Ohio and kind of is a little bit more, you know, the upper indie kind of area. And mm-hmm. that's kind of another separate kind of thing, is that you've got, you know, these big Oscar winners, and then you have like, you know, kind of the interesting indie with lots of effects. And And so it's like really interesting to see how they kind of split off. But I admire them both and all those kind of folks from both sides, you know, both the indie side as well as the big major movie kind of stuff. But some of the people I admire the most are like Steve Tolan, who owns Tolan Effects in Pittsburgh. And he was my mentor, I'd say, you know, right out after college. We both went to the same school. I worked with him quite a bit while I was still in Pittsburgh. And we've kind of watched each other's career kind of open our own studios and kind of how we kind of delved into different things. And it's just really good to see other people working really hard, because most of the people that I went to school with aren't doing this anymore. It's hard. Mm. It's really hard. And kind of, you know, you have to admire anybody that's been doing any of this over a decade, because that means they just, you can't give it up, you know, because it's hard. But Greg McDougall is another guy that I've worked with recently. He's pretty phenomenal. I really admire people that can do everything, because there's a lot of makeup effects artists that go on set and they can apply a fantastic makeup, but they probably can't sculpt it, mold it, cast it, paint it, apply it. And I'm kind of from that old school kind of learn everything, do everything mentality. And it's kind of a hard one to do these days, because it takes a lot of schooling. And I think now you have to be ready to work faster. And so I think if you kind of like pick an aspect, either on set or in the studio, especially, that you're going to have more success if you can decide pretty early on which one of those you're going to do. I wanted to do everything. Greg McDougall, he does everything. You know, I would say, you know, Robert Kurtzman can do everything. You know, all these guys, you know, they can. But a lot of the ones that that you're going to see now, they just do, the ones that get the most acclaim are the ones that often are on set applying it. And that's only maybe a third of the component. Yeah. So it's the final thing. Special effects is a really difficult place for women too. It's a male dominated field for sure. And depending on where you are and what you're trying to get into, it's definitely going to be a factor. Even if you don't think it's a factor, it's a fact. And I admire most, I'd say the qualities I admire most in people is like from Steve Tolan, he doesn't say it can't be done. You know, if a director asks for something, he never says no. He'll say how long it'll take and how much money it'll take. And so I really admire that kind of quality, is that the creative ability to find a way. I also have a lot of respect for one of the directors and the creator of Lovecraft Country, Misha Green. You know, young Black woman in the industry, and she can tell you what she wants. That's also a very important distinguisher in this industry. There's a lot of different ways to do something, and that's with special effects. You know, there's not just one way. There might be 20 different ways to do something, and somebody has to make a decision as to which way it goes. Mm-hmm. And somebody like Misha, she's able to kind of look at something and be very firm about it, what she wants. And it might throw a wrench in the plans because it wasn't what you were expecting, but she's sure what she wants, and the vision's there. And that can really make or break a production as well as a team. You know, you want to have somebody that knows, that isn't wishy-washy in this business.
Well, I know you already spoke a little bit about this, about CGI versus practical effects. And how do you feel about that? Do you feel that CGI is necessary sometimes, or do you think it's just become people are depending on it too much in the industry now and they should use practical effects more than they do?
The most wonderful thing that you can get is a beautiful marriage of practical and digital. It's hard to do because they're two very different skill sets, two very different groups of people, and they're usually not working together. And I think the biggest issue is when you have totally separate teams and producers that don't understand the differences. Practical effects is usually done by a small group of very creative individuals handcrafting something, and you don't exactly know how it's going to end up. You might have this, like, you know, beautiful happy accident that happens when you're sculpting something or, you know, creating something practically and physically. But with CGI, you've got a room of people all doing one little aspect and one person that's directing it. And so it's much more controlled. CGI is precision, but in a way that, you know, they haven't quite gotten past that uncanny valley, you know, and some of it's with, you know, the physics. The physics just aren't there. The actors aren't actually reacting to anything. And there's an element that doesn't feel real. If you can put some portion of that as practical, it's always going to feel more real. Does that mean there's going to be a resurgence of practical effects? Yes and no. I think we're in it right now. I think we've been in it for the last few years. I think there are directors that are now working that grew up in the 80s like I did, that love practical and understand what it's all about. And I know you can relate to this one. I think you just saw it, Possessor, by Brandon Cronenberg. Freaking love it. And if you, I have the kind of a, I don't know if you've seen the behind the scenes interview with him and the effects guys, but they did all that practically, in camera stuff. And it's pretty phenomenal, but they had to really spend a lot of time working it out. And that's the whole thing, is that there's not a lot of lead time, especially when it comes to the big budget stuff. And so what defines that line of whether you should use practical or CGI ultimately comes down to how much prep time do we have? Some films only come together with 30 days prep time. And if you only have 30 days, there's a lot of practical effects you can't do. And so you have to push it off to the end. Whether you like it or not, that might be the only option you have for your film. Or you put massive amounts of money into a big maybe in the front end by splitting it up amongst a bunch of different small practical effects companies. Because even if the big ones are still, they're still not that big. it's still a pretty small industry. But CGI, there's just so many people that have gone to college to do their vector graphics, and they can just farm these people and utilize that capability. Is it better? No. It's the best thing is when you put them together. Like Blade 2. Blade 2 is a fantastic example of the fantastic marriage of practical and CGI. You know, if you need something to be faster, deeper, you know, if you want to remove arms, legs, of course, you know, digital effects is absolutely fantastic for that. You can't do that very well with special effects and practical effects. So, yeah, and just to, you know, kind of clarify for listeners, there's a whole world of, you know, you say special effects, sometimes that, you know, in actual film sets, you're going to, special effects is going to be your rain, your fog, your snow, sometimes the bleeding effects, will the blood itself flowing or like the vomit will all be done by special effects. And you actually have makeup effects, which is all the stuff that touches the actors itself. Mm-hmm. And then you have kind of special props and different things that might also be made by the same kind of special. So special effects is like
broad,
and then you have visual effects, which is generally digital. And so it gets very confusing to the average person what we're talking about when we're talking about special effects. What is it? As a whole, it's creating something. It's tricking the person. It's the magic
Yeah.
You know, you just say special effects is the magic.
Yeah. Well, and I want to talk about some effects that you have done, in particular on the indie film that you did, the 2018 film Eat, which, if people don't know what that's about, it is about an actress who literally starts eating herself, starts with her thumb and then kind of progresses from there. And I'm just wondering, because with those effects, having watched it, I'm just wondering how you did that, because it really looks like she's eating herself. So I'm just wondering what you used to do that, or whatever details you can go into on that, because it just looked so realistic that it was just, wow. That's all I'll say about that. It was really well done, though. Really well done.
Thank you. Eat is probably one of my favorite films, because I can say I was in charge of every aspect of that. You know, it was definitely a very small project. We shot it in 16 days, and it was Jimmy Weber's kind of directorial debut for his first feature film. And so he had raised all the money, like he had basically just saved money all mm-hmm. for 2 years or all summer he was doing political commercials in Washington, to put this movie together. And so he gave me the script and said, how much money would you need? And that's always kind of a tough call, because you don't know how big the film's going to be, et cetera, but like how much absolute minimum can you do this for? It was, and I'll tell you, it was $17,000, and that's not a lot for a movie that has effects in almost every scene.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say that.
We had our first, studio in Colorado. I mean, we did this, what was this? I mean, it came out 2018, but it was probably 2 years before that we did it. And it was my husband's first film working together. He just kind of got involved because I needed his help. And I think that's how a lot of partners get started in the effects industry. I have noticed that almost all the effects companies that I can think of have either a husband and wife or two friends or somebody. You've got to have that partner that's also willing to stay up literally all night to finish something. Mm-hmm. An employee is not going to do that. You know, you've got to have somebody that's just like, you know, it's all small business, and you've got to be able to, like, you know, get through those really tough times. And so in addition to basically Josh, my husband doing the blood rigging and learning how to do it as he went with the bullet hits and blood rigging stuff, I had a few students and I think one proper intern that helped me out with that. So we had maybe five people that were working on this, not even full time. We cast Maggie's chest, arm, and leg, and we created sculpted pieces that it was originally a full fake arm and a full fake leg, but we actually turned the arm into prosthetics, so that because we realized we didn't need to take as much out, we could actually utilize what she had there. But she actually had to bite her toes off, and so we did have to have a prop leg for that. Yeah. And we also knew that she was going to have to eat a lot of this stuff, and because of the budget, we worked with poor man's silicone, which is gelatin. The issues with gelatin is that it can be a little bit hard to apply as prosthetics, as far as stickiness. This was before encapsulated products. So if anybody's listening out there and you knew much about the silicones and gelatins out there, both silicone and gelatin are really hard to stick to the skin without something kind of around it as an encapsulant to help that stickiness. And so it was a little bit of a challenge, but gelatin can also melt under hot cameras in hot summers. Luckily in Colorado, not being too humid and shooting most of this stuff indoors, we did not have any problems whatsoever. And one of the fantastic things about this is that unlike foam latex and different things that you have to do a lot of painting on to make them look like skin, Both gelatin and silicone have a translucency that's very similar to skin. And so we had a formula that worked, that matched Maggie's, our actress's skin. And so we were able to kind of make these pieces that just blended onto her skin really quickly with hot witch hazel. It actually melts the edges of the gelatin. And so it happens pretty quickly. And some of these effects we'd have to have, we might have 20 to 40 minutes to apply a piece and get it going, because 16 days to shoot that entire feature was pretty remarkable. I applaud every single person that worked on that. I think that probably most impressed with those folks. In fact, the DP for that film just made his first feature film, and it's called Rent-A-Pal. And if you haven't seen Rent-A-Pal, you totally should. It's really great.
Yeah,
it's got Will Wheaton in it, and so it's the skills and the abilities of everyone involved there is pretty phenomenal group of people. And so you put in the time. We did every effect. We had different names for different things. We called the initial one the hangnail, the skin tab. And then we had corn cob arm. And then I forget what we called the leg, but those were some of the nicknames we had for things. Some of the edible stuff was actually made from melted gummy bears. So that she could actually chew and eat that. And that film is really, it keeps coming back to me. It's like very, very powerful story in itself. And especially as I look back on almost 20 years working in film, it's about how this industry can consume you and how there's an emptiness that you can get inside yourself trying to be something for movies. Mm-hmm. And it's a dark side, you know. Sometimes your dreams don't come true, and it's gonna be hard. Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty grim, but in a lot of ways appropriate thing. I have to say, when I was in school, one of the things I did was I actively avoided going to LA, because everyone I met in LA. Or from LA had kind of a really jaded, negative attitude about a lot of stuff. And I kind of felt like maybe it was because LA. And now I realize it has a little bit more to do with the bigger films and kind of the difference between working on passion films or having a career and a job that you go to every day that's you doing the same thing all the time. I think a lot of that is having to work with these producer minds that are they don't care about the art of it. It's all about how fast can you do it and how cheap can you do it. Mm-hmm. And it gets very frustrating. You'd asked about those I admire. I do want to say, Rick Baker was always somebody whose work I really it's outstanding and spectacular, as well as the grandfather of special effects, and the one that we all adore is Dick Smith, and he did Amadeus and Little Big Man, and it just pioneered some of the techniques that we still use today. Did some of the best aging effects, which is one of the most difficult things ever. And so those are two very important people in this industry.
But what you're bringing up brings me to a couple of my next questions, because you are based out of Atlanta. And I know you've already mentioned LA and how you view LA and how cold LA can be. And so then, is that part of the reason you decided to work in Atlanta? What is it about Atlanta that is better as opposed to LA?
Well, I mean, not everybody's going to have the experience I've had, but I'm a Colorado girl that went to school in Pittsburgh, spent 6 years in Pittsburgh starting her career, and then went back to Colorado to kind of take a break because of just working too much and kind of being overwhelmed and having a really good friend of mine die in a car accident. So I went back to Colorado, not really expecting to stay there, but knowing I didn't want to go to LA. I wanted to love what I did. I didn't want to get jaded. I didn't want it to turn into a job. And so I tried to make it work in Colorado. There's not a lot in Colorado. And I really didn't expect to stay there, but I did meet my husband. And then we started Monster Makeup Effects. And honestly, a lot of this is just hasn't really been planned. We did what we could. I mean, we started a company, we did classes, we did whatever we could to kind of like, you know, we did student films pretty regularly. It's actually a great business for, you know, smaller cities, because they need effects. And if you're good at it, then they're going to hire you and they're going to spend the money. Mm-hmm. You might be the only person getting paid on the student film, and it may never get finished, but it's going to give you practice and it's going to give them something better than they would have otherwise. So really what happened is we reached our breaking point in Colorado, and we didn't know where to go. We'd heard Atlanta was good, but we were afraid of the bugs and the heat. I'm not a fan of Florida. Florida's like my living nightmare. Which is funny because I actually worked with Joe Blasco in Florida for 8 weeks, 2 years ago. And it just confirmed I don't like Florida. But I've worked all over. You know, I have worked in LA. I've worked in, you know, many states all over. And you go on location. I really like being on location. I also like studio work. So I feel really lucky that I've gotten to do kind of pretty much everything. But to kind of roundabout in this, I got a union job because in Colorado I was union, but it didn't really mean anything because there really wasn't any film. And, you know, we got this Netflix film that came through and it was like, oh my God, we could get hired on this. And then I got a utility job working with construction. And it was, you know, it's like, you can't turn your nose on this down at this. This is like 3 months of union pay. But here I am, the owner of a special effects company, literally sweeping floors for construction. I'm a positive person. I look at things and I think to myself, you can always see some aspect of something awful that teaches you something that you can take forward. And if you can look back on something and extract kind of what lessons you learned or people that you met or things that happened, you can move through this world with a more positive outlook. And so nothing I did, I tried to always kind of look at that. I got to see kind of how a bigger film can be. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot about how they build sets. These were some of the biggest sets I'd ever seen. And I got to kind of watch and learn. And it was like a meditation. It was like a walking meditation every day. Thinking to myself, what are you doing? Where are you going? What are you doing? Where are you going? And at the same time, we had been talking about tiny homes, and we got approached by a TV show about motorhomes, and they were looking for a special effects couple. And it kind of got us thinking about being mobile and being able to, because we, having to live out of hotels, and like if you're on location for different things, it breaks up your life, you know. And I missed my dogs. I missed my husband, because even working on the sweeping floors thing, it was an hour and a half drive every day. It was super long days, and I didn't get to see him 6 days a week, and it was pretty hard. And so thinking about having an RV, being able to have your house nearby, and then maybe also having a special effects studio out of the back, kind of, it got our minds started on this thought. And we started doing a little bit of research. And while I was sweeping that floor, I think I came home one day and I said, let's do it. Let's get this RV and let's hit the road. And it took several months of a very determined effort to, we finally got an SBA loan and we hit the road. And our intention was to take it everywhere, to see all the different markets, and to make ourselves available to a lot of different places, because we thought they shoot movies all over, right? So we went to LA. We actually had a film to shoot out there. And then afterwards, we spent 4 months there. We thought, all right, we're in LA. We're going to give it a try. We're going to really do this. It was right before a potential writer's strike. Not a lot was happening. People were kind of grumpy. And we got this impression, even from people that we knew, that we were friends before, but now that you're here, you're kind of competition, or we don't know what you are because you're something different. You've got this RV. Are you here? Are you not? And we kind of got this impression from just about everybody, because I think a lot of people move to LA and they're not really serious. Go ahead and suffer for a year, and then we'll talk to you. And it's kind of like this rite of passage. And we also got this kind of feeling like, we're California, we've got enough people, sorry, we're closed, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, people were nice, but a little bit frosty. And so it was a little bit different than we expected. We were a little disappointed. And honestly, we were pretty depressed. And we were thrilled when a film that we had just worked on needed us in Colorado for some reshoots. So that pulled us out of LA. And we were, you know, we were going to give it the gung-ho, but we were really happy to have an excuse to move somewhere else, because I don't think it was really for us. It's really a different mentality and attitude there, for sure. And then, you know, we went to Colorado. When we decided to just kind of check out all the different markets, we went through Las Vegas and kind of met with the film commission there. And we kind of talked to some people. And then we went through New Mexico, and they were like, yeah, you should move here. We've got plenty of stuff. And I was like, do you really? you know, they do. But it's like not – like I talked to the one guy that's there that has a studio, and he's not busy all the time. And that's like, mm-hmm. You know, if he's not busy all the time
– then you're not going to be busy all the time.
I'm not going to be busy all the time. And so that didn't seem like – you know, and they all want you to move there because it's very – with the big films, you've got to have a local license. You've got to be part of their locals, or they've got to classify you. Mm-hmm. And so it's much harder. And so we went through Oklahoma. We did the same thing. They've actually got a pretty good film thing in Oklahoma, believe it or not. Even went through Ohio. And then, like, we had some friends that had just moved out to Atlanta, and we decided, there was an effects artist that was looking for a foam runner. I kind of like sent him an email. I said I was available. I'm good at foam, et cetera, et cetera. I had somebody else vouch for me. And I thought to myself, this guy's never going to hire me unless I'm there. I said, we're in Oklahoma. It's, you know, just a few states away. Let's do it. And so we did. We just decided to go ahead and check it out. And we met with our friends that were out here too. And literally within 2 weeks of being here, I got my driver's license and transferred my union membership. But literally the difference between LA and Atlanta was LA was, sorry, we're closed for business. And when I got to Atlanta, they went, well, howdy. You have experience. Isn't that wonderful? Please come right this way. Here's a bunch of work. We love you.
Like, so it wasn't as jaded, basically, too. It wasn't as jaded.
Not at all. Yeah. I mean, not jaded, not, you know, it's booming here. It's still booming here. You know, it's had a little bit of up and down since, you know, not even talking about COVID, but like, you know, we had like 4 months where there wasn't any work and people were losing their minds. And as from, you know, working in Colorado and struggling through all kinds of different things, I thought 4 months, that's nothing.
That's nothing.
You know, you should be ready to survive 4 months with very little by doing something else. I mean, that's kind of the skills that we've gotten from having to work in a non-major market, is the ability to kind of just do something else while you can, in some other way to survive, so that you're not counting on, you know, full-time work.
Because you've worked on independent projects and you've worked on big studio projects. And I know we have talked before we did this interview a little bit about what the pros and cons are. And I know you've talked about producers versus directors and the art versus commerce and the money versus all that stuff. So which do you prefer? And if you want to talk just a little bit about what your experience is with working on those.
Sure, absolutely. I don't know if I can say which one I have a preference of, though. it kind of boggles my mind a little bit. I came at this with the desire to keep the passion. And so I've been kind of like fiercely independent for a good portion of my career. So a lot of the stuff I've worked on was independent. And I love that feeling. There's, you know, my favorite part about working in film is the people and the team and creating something together that's awesome. There's pros and cons in the independent for that. In the large part, because you might think you're working on something wonderful and then you finally see it, it's really disappointing. There's several films that I've worked on in the independent market that are really good. You know, for example, Strange Girls, which is one of the ones that I worked on that was actually shot on film with a female director. It's just really good. And then Eat and Motivational Growth and some just like really spectacular. Hoax was wonderful. That was the one that almost broke me because I did too much on it. However, it's these passionate directors that you can then take and talk to directly. You're talking directly to the director. You're creating something with this person, and you're putting all of your creative force into it, and a lot of your heart, and I was able to be a department head and hire small teams and work with really wonderful people to really push things through and create new things. And so that's kind of the independent world, is that you have more importance. The film itself may never get known. It may never get seen. You talk to your friends and they're like, oh, I just finished a film. Oh yeah, what was it? Oh, I've never heard of that. And so there's kind of a frustration there that, you know, you put so much work into something and either very few people saw it or nobody saw it, or it didn't turn out as well as you hoped. And so there's a long time waiting for, you know, sometimes independent films can take upwards of 10 years to come out. One of the first films I ever worked on just came out recently. And I was like, oh no. So, you know, that's kind of the heartbreaking part of it. And you know, you're probably not getting paid enough. You're probably doing way longer days than not getting any overtime or, you know, sick time or, you know, healthcare for sure. And so like, yeah, that's probably good for people starting out, but you might want to, if you want to make a career out of this, transition faster into something bigger because it is a different ballgame. And if you want to support yourself and actually have a career, working on union stuff is the way to go because they have the money. And one of the best things about working on union stuff is that you get these wonderful things like an actual livable wage that also goes into time and a half at like after 8 hours and then goes into double time at 10 hours. And then if they, you know, don't break at lunch on time, you get like a bump every 15 minutes they go over, and you're just like cha-ching, and there's really great food and like but and the best thing about that is that you know I have a Walking Dead jacket that I got on wrap from my department head on season 8. And you wear this thing out and it's like people look at you different. They get all excited. They're like, ooh, you work on The Walking Dead. That's amazing. You don't get that when you work in independent film. You don't get, hey, you worked on Eat. Oh, I know you. Like, no way. Like, people aren't going to know that. And so there's kind of a social, I don't want to say, not cost, but like bonus that you get from working in these other films, in the bigger stuff, in the union things. And so you've got that. You've got great pay. But the downsides are that it takes over your life. We're still working 14, 17 hours a day, so oftentimes 6 days a week, for a machine that really doesn't care if you have a doctor's appointment or a dentist's appointment, or you need to go do something with your family, or you have a dog at home. Like, occasionally I have worked on some films where, you know, you can bring your dog to work, or like the department heads can bring their dogs to work, or like, you know, that are a little bit more humane. I got, you know, they give you time off to actually do your physical therapy because you hurt your wrist, you know, on the last show. And then there's other shows that don't allow you to, that you should assume that they're the most important thing in your life and nothing else exists. They don't want to hear anything. Like, it's just yes, yes. And on top of that, you probably don't have much or any creative control. I feel lucky that, you know, there are some things that I've gotten to do that have been a lot of fun, like building cardboard robots for the Halloween episode of Stargirl. I was covering for a friend of mine working in the aging and dying costumes department, and sometimes they just come up to you and they say, "We need these things. Can you do it?" And I was like, "Yeah." And you get to like go to Home Depot and buy like, you know, all the flashy light things and some spray paint, and go to the thrift store and get like a colander and like, you know, and build these like cool ass robot costumes that were awesomely featured, by the way. I was super excited. I watched that episode the other day and I was like, yay. But, you know, and so you have moments where maybe like, you know, I know the person that did like Daryl's jacket, you know, the aging on that, or just like some element of it, you know, when you see it on screen, you know, you did that little bit, that one little thing there. And so there's moments of that, but you're not, I mean, unless you're the designer or, you know, even then, like, it's being controlled so much by, you know, this congregation of producers that all get input as to what it should look like and what it needs to be. And there's kind of a cool thing about that. You know, I actually really enjoyed over the last few years just being able to be like, yep, just tell me where to go. I'm happy to not think. This is fantastic. Just pay me that awesome check and give me my healthcare. Mm-hmm. This is fantastic. And so I think if you're that type of person, man, it's golden. And I was thinking that maybe I was this kind of person because we really got into it. And then COVID struck. And literally over the last year, we've been out of it and questioning if we want to give our lives back to it. If we're a little too independent to have somebody else tell us what to do and to just sit. Because sometimes, whether you're a makeup artist, whether you're a costume person, you're going to be sitting during the hurry up and wait of filmmaking. There's a lot of wait, you know, mm-hmm. you work your butt off, and then sometimes you're just sitting or standing there for hours and you're thinking, this is my life, you know, and at least you're making money, but you're giving your life. And, you know, we just got a kitten. We have a dog that's really attached and has separation anxiety. And the idea of being gone all day, I mean, it's like, if I could do this part-time, that would be perfect. Mm-hmm. But they don't take you part-time. I just did like a muscle suit for a superhero show here locally. And I just, you know, it was just a quick thing, you like 2 days, and then suddenly it's like, are you available tomorrow? Are you available tomorrow? And I was like, maybe a day or two a week. But then, you know, with the COVID testing, and like you have to get tested, and then you're cleared 2 days later, and they're testing every four times a week, and you're trying to avoid like everyone, and it's a different world now, mm-hmm. on set as well.
Yeah. Well, and so you've touched on a lot of the things. So I kind of want to transition then, because that brings up You started a personal chef business. So was that because you were thinking, I don't know if I want to get back into this, or I don't know if I want to give my whole life to this, so I'm going to find some other way? Or was that part of because also COVID, or what inspired you to do that?
Just kind of like to put it out there, I think creativity and the ability to adapt are elements that we don't teach our kids enough. We don't kind of allow ourselves. We get very kind of stuck into this is who I am. This job is who I am. And that's my identity. I think that's a lot of how I feel over the last, nearly 20 years is I'm a special effects artist. That's who I am. I work in movies. I love movies. And to be honest, the first part of the lockdown, like the first part, we're all thinking we'll be back to work in June. This is only mm-hmm. temporary. It's going to be just fine. We'll play some video games and take a break like we've never had. I've never taken unemployment before. This is great. We're getting paid. We can order our Amazon and just kind of like kick back and relax for once. And so that was kind of nice. And then it kept going. And you started to think, well, then who am I? You know, if I'm not doing effects. And then I started thinking like, well, I should be sculpting. I should be creating something. Isn't that what I love? I'm a special effects artist. And I kept finding that I had no motivation, zero, to do anything creative except cooking. Literally, like, the only thing that I could get excited about at all was, oh my gosh, I think I'm going to learn how to bake this kind of bread. Or, you know, I really want this kind of takeout, but I don't want to go get takeout, so I'm going to learn how to make it. And I've always wanted to challenge myself. I don't think any of us should ever stop learning. I think you should always be challenging yourself. I think that's when we feel alive, is that, when we're just slightly out of our comfort zone. And so I think that's also another thing, is that there was nothing that I was doing at home that was kind of out of my comfort zone. There was nothing really challenging me, and I felt really kind of depressed. I really struggled with not working as somebody that didn't work or has worked since they were 15. I watched a lot of cooking show competitions on TV, and it kept, like, you know, I watched a lot of Bobby Flay, and I think in Bobby Flay, at least, especially, they just kept mentioning personal chef, like, here's the personal chef of Steven Spielberg. And I was like, okay, yeah, of course he has a personal chef. Like, and I came across a, I don't know what happened first, honestly. I found this chefpreneur guy that was kind of teaching chefs from from restaurants that are out of work how to start their own personal chef business. And I was kind of looking into that a little bit, and I started kind of like, oh, okay, this is something that is kind of more affordable and that normal people, like not Steven Spielberg, are actually can maybe afford and do. And it kind of like, I just learned that that was kind of a thing. I mean, it's just honestly exactly what happened with special effects. One day I opened up a Fangoria magazine, and I saw an ad for three ads for different schools that taught special effects. And you go, oh my God, that's something you can do and get money? That's what I have to do. That's me. And it almost happened the same way with this. It was like, oh my God, like, something else I'm really passionate about is something I could actually do, at least for now. And I think I was really depressed one day, and I didn't even want to get out of bed. But what I did do is I grabbed my iPad and I just opened up Squarespace, and I just started playing with the website. I was like, I have all these, I'd been taking photos of all the food I'd been making for months. And so I had all these beautiful food photos, And I just started plugging them in and kind of putting some stuff together. And then, you know, I did this kind of like 14-day chefpreneur class thing, and it got me going. It was just like, okay, here's the steps. You know, you've started a business before. You kind of know some of this stuff. Just give it a try. And so that's kind of the exciting part of starting a business is the very beginning. Then it got really scary. Hey, I've registered my business. Now I need clients. Like, everybody thinks it's great that I've done this, but now what do I do? And I'm still struggling to reach out because I don't want too many people. I don't want to do groups of, like, you know, I get requests from these different websites and stuff for groups of people, and I'm not there yet with COVID. My precautions are pretty severe, and what that has led me to is working with other people, especially in the film industry. What I wanted specifically to do, make good food for my friends in film that don't have time to make dinner or are going into work for lunches that are, you know, talking about how great the food is on these big sets. It was better before COVID. They kind of had this adjustment period where they would just get a box of cold food, of something that they checked off, you know, an hour ago, and then some PA had to kind of bring to them. And so, like, it wasn't like these great catering smorgasbords that you could build your own salad and do all this stuff with. And I think over COVID, a lot of people didn't eat well, were more sedentary. I gained weight. I know that. And so a lot of people were struggling to eat right. And so I wanted to be able to help my film family. And so I actually called the company Film Family Food. And I want to make good food for my film family. And right now, it's like it comes full circle. I'm actually cooking for, I can't say who, because it would be a spoiler, but I'm cooking for one of the cast members of The Walking Dead. And so that's pretty cool. And, you know, some other crew that, you know, here and there for different things, but I don't know how long I'm going to do this, but I, the more I do it, the more I realize that I can make similar amounts of money with less stress. And maybe I'm going to do this for a minute, but it's probably not. I'm one of those people, I follow my heart mm-hmm. and my passion. And I also want to direct. Actually, at the very beginning of COVID, I finally got my director's reel together. And it was just so ironic. I got a tattoo that said "The Dream Never Dies" for an actor friend of mine that worked in, he acted his entire life. And so it's filmmaking and movies and all that. It's in my heart. It's in my blood. I think I'll always be connected to it. I think different aspects of it I'm going to explore, and I'm not going to say what's going to happen. But right now I know that food is fascinating me. And just like makeup, it's a temporary art that is also kind of a meditation. You know, when I'm chopping, when I'm cooking, I'm not thinking about the worries of the world. When I'm applying a makeup, I'm not thinking about anything else. It's like you go into a zone, and that's kind of the beauty of these elements, is that it can transport you, or transports me to a place of calm.
Okay, well, and I really loved that first part and really loved what Midian had to say. And things have changed since that first interview, of course. So here is the second part of the interview where we just sat down recently and talked about a lot of great things. So I just think you'll really enjoy this. So here is part two of my interview with Midian. Okay, so Midian, thank you so much for coming back and updating me, because I know the last time we spoke, it was like back on like March 13th or 14th or something like that. It was so long ago. Well, I wanted to ask you, because I know you've been doing a lot of projects and I know you can't speak about them, but I wanted to know, what is it like right now in the age of the pandemic? Because we are still in a pandemic, everybody. People seem to want to forget that. What is it like working on sets right now?
It's interesting because
working on sets at the moment is we've all kind of gotten into a routine. They call it, you know, if you're working regularly, they call it cadence. And if you get called for a job and you just, it's for a day or so, you might get asked, are you in cadence? And that means, are you being tested 3 times a week? And are you on schedule? Because otherwise they have to schedule a new test for you. So there's just lots of testing, a lot of variance between how deep and hard the testers go digging for the specimens. And, you know, it's a real challenge for the production because if anybody gets COVID, they have to like shut down that little segment of people that were associated with them. And sometimes if you're working with, depending on the project, if you're working with what we call first team or the primary talent, and you're going to be close to them, you have to wear a device that tracks you, like just basically kind of pings off of other trackers all day. And so that if somebody does come up positive, they can figure out who you were within for that amount of time, you know, for longer than 15 minutes or whatever their amount of time is. There are COVID officers everywhere. And kind of, and this will springboard into some other things. I'll try and remember to come back to it, but it definitely seems like it's a bit of both, you know, ultimately it's for the production's safety. It's not necessarily for our safety. It's mm-hmm. for the safety of the primary actors and the production's pocketbooks. Because what can happen is if they get a positive COVID case, that it totally, they might have to completely rearrange the schedule. Mm-hmm. They have to like pay people to just stand down. So it's been a huge cost for the productions, and it's difficult for everyone. So, but we're doing it. Basically, there's a huge demand for entertainment, so the show must go on, right? And it's, you get used to it. There are things that I do to kind of help protect myself a little bit more when I'm working with, like, say, background. We kind of thought that maybe the age of COVID, we would see a lot less background. And maybe that was the case, you know, for the shoots that we're doing going on during lockdown. But it's right back to the same old. It's hundreds of backgrounds. And you're working through these people. And sometimes they're the ones coming on the day, getting a rapid test, which is less effective. And I think they get both sometimes, but the rapid one has to come back clear before they can get in at all. And it's just like, I mean, there's so many details I could bore you with it. Ultimately, we have to kind of, you know, look out, make sure we wear our masks. One of the things I do when I'm dealing with a lot of people is I wear one of those little fans around my neck. And it just kind of blows up right across my face. And so what it's doing is taking any breath that might be coming out of my mask and blowing it up, as well as any air that's coming from them towards me. Particularly if you're doing makeup, the person can't be wearing a mask. And so we have to wear a mask, obviously, the whole time. I don't know. I think it helps. I don't know. We'll see. I haven't, you know, I don't want to say anything, but I'm going to knock on wood. So, you know, you get used to it though. It's nice. Some productions offer mask breaks. Some don't. Sometimes you just have to go find a spot and get some air. It sucks wearing a mask all day long, but I'm sure a lot of professions already know that. So it's what we have to do. And now productions are coming up with, you know, mandatory vaccines for anybody in the red zone, which is, you know, working with primary cast. And that's causing some hubbub. You know, a lot of people are very upset about that, especially here in Georgia, where I think the vaccination rate is only about 40% right now. So
yikes.
Went out and got takeout yesterday, and nobody on the streets, nobody in the stores, wearing a mask. Not a single one. And if you look, and the looks I get for wearing a mask is like ridiculous. And I feel like saying, like, listen, guys, I'm doing this for you.
I know. It happens here too. Even though we've got a much higher vaccination rate, it happens here when I wear, because I'm vaccinated, but I still wear my mask, you know. But you do, you'll get those looks of like, what are you doing? Why are you wearing a mask, you idiot? And I'm just like, well, okay, whatever. You're the idiot. I'm not the idiot here, frankly. That's the way I kind of view it. But it
seems amazing. Yeah. You know, the misinformation is really powerful. And it's sad.
Scary.
Working on film, it has been full blast since I talked to you. It's like a different world since we talked earlier. It's been a roller coaster ride of specialty costuming and some aging and dying, and then whammo, right into prosthetics and lots of makeup and life casting, and we've been just like slammed. Thank goodness we just moved, and I've had like a couple of weeks off to try and get settled here at the house. So it's been really nice. But as a day player, as somebody that doesn't work as a full-time position on anything, anytime we're not working, pretty much we're panicking. And it's really hard to have downtime and actually enjoy it, because as an artist, you're thinking, everybody hates me. Nobody's going to hire me again. I'll never work again. And this is just an artist's mind.
When it is.
It's just like we're suddenly worthless again.
It is. It's that self-doubt and that self, like, questioning everything you do and everything you say. And yeah.
I'm getting better at it as I get older. I'm really enjoying my days off on purpose now.
Okay. Yeah, well, and I know, you know, that leads me into my other question, because I know IATSE is thinking of striking, right, because of the conditions for people. I mean, I don't think people realize how many, just the casual viewer, I don't think they realize how much goes into a movie, to a television show, how many people work behind the scenes, that it's not just the director, writer, and the stars, that there are a ton of crew members that have to work hours and hours and hours and hours. And I know a lot of people are coming forward talking about unfair working conditions, that they're being worked beyond what they should be worked, working overtime without necessarily getting any kind of compensation for it, or at least not getting fair pay for it. And especially now, when you also have to work with the hazard of dealing with COVID and the potential of even if you are vaccinated, even if you are, there is still that risking your life factor to it as well, I think. But even risking your life in the fact that you might be really exhausted and you have to drive home after that, and how are you, you know, that kind of thing. So as much as you're comfortable speaking about it, what are your thoughts on the potential strike that might happen, or anything you want, any information you want to give about that?
Sure. Yeah, this is unprecedented. Things that are happening right now. Generally, each section of the IATSE union, which handles a lot of the crafts that are behind the camera, or camera itself, that you know, non-actor unions are all over the country, and they all kind of operate fairly independently, but under one code, the international. It is part of like a worldwide union group, but there's never been kind of a full movement for all of IATSE to kind of take a stand. And what's been happening, and this has been, you know, printed publicly, so these are things I can talk about that aren't you know, union secrets or anything, but there has been some major contract stalls. Basically, the production companies aren't budging. We've been trying to get things like better turnarounds. And what that means is, when you stop working, what time do you need to be back at work? And sometimes those are often 9 or 10 hours. And when you think to yourself, well, okay, so a 9-hour turnaround, you've got an hour and a half drive on either side. So that's 3 hours out of that 9. So now you're at 6 hours, and then you get home. Maybe you have a snack. Maybe you see your kids or your pets or your significant other for 10 minutes, and then you have to get to bed. in order to get maybe 4.5 hours of sleep so that you can get up, get ready, get back to work. This can go on over and over again for weeks at a time. And what is happening too, since there is such this like demand for entertainment right now, is that there are also a lot of these studios are working under a contract that is, for quote unquote new media. And that is all the streaming stuff. Fact is, it's not new anymore. They've been getting away with a lot of discounts and special rates and things for quote unquote new media. And they're making just a killing on these things and making tons of money. And it's not relating to any of the workers. Typical work week for somebody that is, say, my profession, makeup, is you would get there sometimes 2 or 3 hours before crew call, which is when most everybody else comes in. That's when the actors have to get made up and get ready. And then they shoot for maybe at least a 12, sometimes a 14, and up to, a 16, 17 hour day. And then we have to clean them up and get rolling. And so what that does is with these mandatory turnarounds, and what they'll do is sometimes they'll just pay the fee for some folks. Sometimes they'll ask people to just kind of come in anyway or whatever. It doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen in certain departments really frequently, especially PAs, because they're not even unionized. They get abused unbelievably. And a lot of people, it's like we love this work. And so they take advantage of that love. It's like we get in this, we want to like really work hard. We want to show that we can do these like outrageous things in minimal time. And we keep doing what they ask for less and less. And we keep doing it. And they go, great, we can do this next time. And so the fewer and fewer people doing more and more. And now what they're doing, it used to be occasionally, towards the end of a season or the end of the film, you'll start maybe working through lunch and they'll bring you a box lunch and you eat when you can. It's usually cold and awful, or they'll try and just break people occasionally, in scattered moments. But you don't get that like 30 minutes all company break, which is sometimes the time. I mean, 30 minutes is not a lot of time to get your food, sit down, eat anyway. But sometimes you need to make that phone call. You need to talk to your significant other because you don't see them during the week. You need to like do something. And what they're doing now is they're taking that away. They're just paying the mill penalties. And so people are working these 14, 17 hour days without, especially like camera on. Certain people can't even sit down. PAs can't sit down. Camera usually doesn't sit down. And so they're literally on their feet all day long and they're burning us out. And so we'll start sometimes at 4 a.m. on a Monday. And as the week goes on, you might be starting at 5 p.m. on a Friday. And so we call that a Fratterday. And what that does is it also steals part of our weekend. A lot of productions are also doing Saturdays. And so they're basically working us to death and just paying tiny little pittance to kind of like keep us satisfied. Well, we're not happy anymore. And we're starting to realize that we've all just been kind of holding it in and suffering alone. And one of the things that has happened recently is there's an Instagram called IA Stories. And it's anonymous stories from those both in and out of IATSE working in film. Anybody working in film has submitted. It's specifically for IATSE, but a lot of other folks have chimed in. And it is like the worst horror stories you've ever read. The things that are done to people on movie sets and the way people are treated like absolute garbage, replaceable garbage. We've worked years, sometimes spent, hundreds of thousands of dollars on gear, on education, on specialty skills, on, doing this for decades. And that we're not easily replaceable, but we're treated as though we are. And everybody's been kind of suffering in silence. And so now with IA Stories, it's getting a lot of these out, and we're starting to realize that we are all collectively suffering. And if we collectively work together, we can improve the quality of our lives. We can actually reduce maybe the divorce rate in film. Maybe, you know, there's so many stories of people just never seeing their parents or a parent because of film. And it's a shame because, you know, in the end, we're just making entertainment. There's no need for this. It can be done in less time. When you see some of the things that they shoot, you don't really know why we just spent 4 hours on that. And it's just, it's maddening when you realize that it's, you know, some people are like, hey, I love the overtime. Yeah, until you wrap your car around a telephone pole at 6 o'clock in the morning after a 20-hour day. There is a limit. And that's why you don't see a lot of people over 40 doing a lot of these jobs, because it's really rough. And people get permanent damage to their systems and their brains.
In your mental health.
Yeah. I read one of the IA stories recently said, I think it was a psychologist or it was a brain doctor of some kind, basically heard about how our weeks go. And he said it was something like flying across the country every day and dealing with that kind of jet lag. And then also driving to or flying to Tokyo every week and resetting your body literally every week through that. And he said he's surprised that more of us aren't psychotic.
It's scary. It's scary.
Rampant abuse of alcohol and drugs to lift people up and drag them down and like try and get enough sleep in the time that you've got. And a lot of people are just suffering alone because we don't know. And now we know, and there is a huge movement across the entire country right now. And it's not that we're necessarily about to go on strike. It's that we are about to vote on the option to strike, which allows the main negotiators to go back to the table with the producers and the production companies. And say, listen, you can't do without everyone. So they're ready to strike. How about you come to a deal now? Because they really have not been listening. They have gotten to the end of what they're willing to do. And we've been on a temporary extension for months now on this contract. And they don't want to hear it. And so this is what has to happen, and we're all for it. It's nice to know that, you know, it's not likely that we're going to actually have to strike, and if we do strike, it'll probably be a pretty short one. there's actually a really positive buzz because we are realizing what being a union actually does. It gives us that collective, and the collective is communicating now. So I'm very excited that, you know, working conditions might change. What we want is a normal day. We give up extra years of our life working just to do film. By the time we have lunch, most people have finished their work day. That's 8 hours for most of us. And so we've got another 8 hours to go after that. It's rough. We just want to work maybe a 12-hour day instead and get lunch. Like, we're not really asking for that much. Not only that, but I'm finding out the most horrible things from these IA stories. Like script supervisors, there are a lot of, in the contract, there are a lot of minimums for certain categories of folks. And like a script supervisor, super important, very highly skilled job. Very difficult to move up from. Usually it's to writer, but it doesn't happen very often. And they kind of get stuck in this job. And I was absolutely horrified to find out that the base wage for a script supervisor, which they don't like to pay more than, is $18 an hour.
Wow. That's horrifying. Ridiculous.
These people are working through their entire weekends and hours after work unpaid just to keep up, because it's more than a one-person job now, because you've got multiple cameras, you've got multiple things happening, and they just expect the same one person to do it. Mm-hmm. And that was really disappointing. It's like, it's for a person that's been in film for 20 years, like, some of the stuff is really shocking to me. You know, that I always thought it was better on the union side, and a lot of it is, but a lot of it isn't. Like, boy.
Yeah. I just briefly going out at to the Colorado Festival of Horror, I just got a brief taste just of the fact that, you know, I hadn't eaten anything in 12 hours because I was running around interviewing people, doing stuff. And just that little bit of not eating for 12 hours and that just takes something out of you, where your brain's not functioning the same way and you're trying to do stuff, and it's really hard on your system. And you know, I think people have this mindset, people, you know, just out in the general public who aren't working in that medium, I think they have this idea in their head that, well, you're doing something fun, so stop complaining and who cares? But you know, I mean, people shouldn't be dying or shouldn't be ruining their lives for this. I mean, and for the chance to get to do what they love to do, it shouldn't make it where, you know, in the end, maybe it'll taint that thing you love. So it shouldn't do that to people. So what are things, and also I want to throw out there, everybody, we are following that account on our Instagram account. So if you want to find that Instagram account, if you're having a trouble finding it for any reason, go to the accounts that we are following and you will find it there. And definitely read some of those stories, because they are horrifying and sad, and they will make you see things differently if you haven't already. But I want to know, Midian, is there anything that people in the general public, people that just watch and consume media, can do to support the union at all? Or,
boy, that's a great question. You know, and I don't necessarily have a ready answer, but I think being informed and knowing and making your voice heard, you know, even if it's just a comment with solidarity with the movement that's going. Handwritten emails to production companies saying that you as a consumer don't appreciate the abuses that are going on and would like to see change would actually mean more than our words right now, because you guys are the ones that are, you know, of course we all consume media, but we're kind of like the silent majority, and you guys are the majority as far as like the listeners, the people that are out there doing this. And so if, you know, for every one person that writes in, it kind of represents so many more that care. And so the companies that hear these complaints do tend to take them seriously when there's enough of them. So if you have a few minutes, just look up the Google has everything you need to know as far as where to go, and do us a solid and write these folks and say you see what's going on, or just be involved, take a look, read the IA stories and make a comment, share them with your friends, just so that people are aware of what's going on, and stand with us and support. That would be wonderful.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Midian. And I will put a link to that Instagram account in our show notes so that people can, instead of just going to our Instagram, you can just go there and show your support and solidarity. And of course, we stand with you as well. This podcast does. But I think it would mean more, like Midian said, coming from like your personal email account and doing stuff like that. And as a consumer. Saying something. So thank you again, Midian. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Erin. It's been such a pleasure to be a part of this podcast. And I wish you all the best in the future. And may this reach many, many more ears.
You're great.
Thank you so much. Thank you. You are too. Thank you. Seriously, thank you. Thank you so much, Midian, again, for sitting down again with me to talk to me. Please make sure to check out Midian's work at MunsterMakeupEffects.com. You can see her work there. You can find contact information. You can also follow her on all social platforms at MunsterMidian. You can find her on Facebook and I believe on Instagram, on Twitter. And once again, I'm going to be posting a link also to the IA Stories account on Instagram. So please be sure to follow that. Listen to those stories. You may think you can't do anything, but like Midian said, you know, we are consumers, and as consumers, you know, we also have to make our voices heard. So since you are consuming that media, try and stand with the people that are making that media, because there's a lot of abuses going on. So this podcast stands with them, and I hope you will too. Thank you so much. And next week on the show, we are going to be first talking about queer horror. So we're going to have again Roman and Tyler, the directors of Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm very excited to have them back. And so we're going to be talking about queer horror. That's going to be a fun conversation. And then next Friday, we are going to be talking about Nia DaCosta's Candyman, as well as the original. I'm not going to say the name again because I'm so worried I'm going to say it, you know, five times. But we're going to be talking about both of those, and that should be a lot of fun. So I'm really looking forward to that. Excuse me. So until next time, remember, it's a fandom thing. Black Lives Matter, and stop Asian hate.